This conversation is being had constantly. It is you and your party who are not listening. And interesting, too, that he says we have to find a path forward together, but has invited zero Indigenous people to be on this town hall to talk about this issue. And he says there has to be an end to reconciliation. Yeah, but there also has to be a beginning. And what you're wanting to do is undo the bare minimum stuff that's been done? I don't think so. He talks about how there will never be equality for everybody because people are born different and there should be equal opportunity. I guess you've missed the like first grade versions of the difference between equality and equity that we've been having for the last, again, decades. Interesting, too, one of the things that really struck me is he talks about if you look around the world at laws that are applied where there are laws legislated to one person over another person, it creates conflict. And the example that he gives is if I split this room in half and I said this half can't go through the gate and this half can go through the gate, right? What examples around the world are you talking about? Because what that brings to me is things like apartheid and Nazi Germany, where rights were stripped from one group in favor of another. These worldwide issues that you're talking about don't typically impact or harm the dominant power in an area, right? I really think that you need to rethink how you're looking at that, because calling apartheid friction misses the point in a major way. Now, you didn't say apartheid. I'm reading that from what you said. But I think it's really important because you said, look around the world at instances where laws are applied to one person or group over another. That is a great example of that. And he asked, again, how do you fix historical problems? How do you right those wrongs? How do you find a path forward? You make more effort than zero. And I'm not going to get into the property stuff because I'm an anarchist, frankly, and private property is theft and, whatever, forget it. I'm not even going to go down that road with him because conservatives are capitalists and I'm not going to engage with a capitalist on their terms. So, now, again, this is not to platform John Rustad. This is to make sure everyone has an opportunity to hear the crap that came out of his mouth. Now we're going to move into the Q&A. I'm going to more or less let these just run out. I might put some musical transitions in different places. I'm going to put, like I said, as many of these as I possibly can in here. It's a 2-hour show. I'm doing my best. And I'll pop back in at the end to talk some more. So once again, this is from the February 7th town hall hosted by three white conservatives about DRIPA. And this is now going to be people's responses. And from what I saw, I want to put my hands up and just say thank you all for not just letting this lie. So let's get into it. Here we go.
On behalf of the Gitomden Hereditary Chiefs, and actually Denise Etwas and Sakazet Gilget, we just want to acknowledge that the territory that you're situated on and that you've come to do business on is Gitomden. The territory is called Gitomden. It's been a part of our long-standing
right on, history. Sherry.
And I thought it's really important that we start things in a good way. You know, when we're talking about reconciliation, one of the most important things in reconciliation is, number one, if you have a conflict and you've caused harm to somebody, you don't get to say what reconciliation looks like. You have to talk to Indigenous people, and I agree with you that it shouldn't continue to go on and on and on. And when you said, you know, this is what I think it looks like, that's a part of the problem. You know, we're not reconciling. We're taking it from your perspective and what reconciliation should look like. It's really important The reason it's going on and on is a lack of perspective from the indigenous people who've had harm imposed on them. And I also agree that when you say, like, what's it going to look like if your houses are situated on indigenous territory, because indigenous people can make laws. You know, they can change the structure of what you currently know. Canadian law, the Canadian government has been able to make laws for years. You know, I think all of the fear-mongering that you're doing, yes, Indigenous will be able to make laws, but Canadians have been doing that to people all over Canada, including British Columbia. You know, I don't think you should be taking this from a fear perspective. And we've never, you know, and similar to the Nishka people and who've gotten to this place of treaty, there's never been an intention ever to displace people. We've lived among the people that are in our valley for so many years. And reconciliation is important to the people of this valley from my experiences, just as much as it is to us as Indigenous people. And I forgot to introduce myself. My name is Chief Madik. I'm one of the three head chiefs of the Gidimden clan, whose territory that you're situated on. So for me and my perspective, when you talk about dividing people, conversations and how you started this conversation does exactly that. And you're traveling throughout this province, starting these conversations in a horrible way. Yep. You know, and it's self-serving. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that doesn't do anything for reconciliation, but could cause further harms to something that you're claiming to want to rectify. It's really important that we start these conversations from a place of respect. And not just the respect for the Indigenous people, but for the people who've been living among us for so many years. You know, it's not healthy. It's not okay. So, you know, I welcome all of you who are continuing to live among us. We work and play amongst each other. Woo!
Thank you. Good one.
Thank you for that, and I appreciate that. Thank you, and thank you for welcoming us. And I know, I remember I was having a conversation with the Tsokwatin leaders back in 2015 after the case, and we were talking about how to proceed and the work to be done in their territory. I remember we got to a place where we were talking about it, and I said something to them that, you know, I meant from my heart, which is one day I hope they'll be able to forgive us for what we did to the Tsokwatin people. Because it's true. The wrongs that have happened. You know, when you mentioned, you know, First Nation laws, in this country, in democracy, there are some fundamental components, things that are foundational to society, that I believe in, and I will always stand and defend, and I won't be apologetic about it. I'm sorry if they defend somebody. But if somebody is creating laws that are going to impact people, those people have a right to vote for that government that creates those laws. If somebody's going to be implementing taxation, people have a right to vote for the people who are implementing taxation. And this is where the conflict is, and I agree with you entirely. The challenge is we have Canada, which has existed, which is over top of traditional territories of First Nations. And we have British Columbia over top of those nations. And the question is, so whose authority, who has the authority for the laws and for the things like taxation? And if the authorities are all the 204 First Nations in British Columbia, then you've got 204 different nations in British Columbia. Canada doesn't exist in British Columbia anymore, if that's the case. And you're creating some sort of other type of arrangement. And if that's the goal, then please come out and say it. Because we would have to change our constitution, we'd have to change this. Otherwise, it's Canada that implements the laws, it's British Columbia that implements the laws for Indigenous and non-Indigenous alike. And yes, Indigenous have the ability, you know, certainly the court cases have said this, in terms of creating laws and doing things for on their territory. But this is where the friction comes in. Because if the people who are living on the territory are not Indigenous, they don't have a right to vote. They don't have a right to run for government. They don't have a say on in terms of an Indigenous government and implementation. And this is where this rub comes. How do we reconcile those differences? And that's a challenge. You know, for example, in Haida, with the recent agreement with the provincial government and the Haida Nation, Haida's, you know, title has been declared over the entire entire islands, which includes all the private property and includes all the infrastructure that's on the island. So what that means is that Indigenous law will apply, and that's written very clearly, will apply to their lands. Now, it's in there in terms of how they protect private property rights as part of that legislation, but ultimately, no provincial legislation can override Section 35 rights. So that legislation will not stand up if it's ever challenged. And so this is why this is a big, important issue that needs to be talked about. And we can't be afraid, despite how challenging an issue and difficult this is, we can't be afraid to have this conversation. How do we resolve these things?
Foremost, I want to acknowledge everybody that is under this roof. I'm glad that I let Sherry speak before me because she had spoken everything that I wanted to say. And when you're really focusing on truth and reconciliation, that word tends to be non-actionary. And when action starts happening with truth and reconciliation, we take two steps forward and then we take three back. Because of the hateful rhetoric and the divisional tactics that is happening today. We've been living in the North forever, and we've always had reconciliation here. We've always had truth here in the North. And with you coming today, because it's working in other areas of the province, it's not gonna work in the North because we work together here. So I don't know what your intentions are on coming here, but we're working fine here. I think you should just step aside and let us live the way we're living, because truth is alive here. And reconciliation is actively going. And with this fear-mongering that's happening, that's not gonna happen here. We have unceded territory here. We have like respectful relationships with a diversity of people that live in this area. And I'm actually really disappointed on the conversations that's happening today, because that hateful rhetoric is not gonna work here outside.
Awesome, Jackie.
My name is Sarah Newton, and I live in Smithers. I'm a relative newcomer here, and I have felt very welcomed by Indigenous people and settler people. And I know there's a lot of divisiveness in this topic, and it is, as you said, very disappointing. The idea, like just fear-mongering and trying to pit people against each other, I don't understand. DRIPA is a mechanism with no ulterior motives. There's no money behind it. It is successfully working in Norway. Norway has higher standards of living than here. Norway is not bought out by big business, same as New Zealand, where Truth and Reconciliation and DRIPA have been working. You can try and shoot holes in that, but the reality is the Canadian Constitution and the court system is trying to implement a long-term plan where people can get along. They're trying to implement a plan that is not divisive. And that is the bottom line, is it is a mechanism that works. And if we keep trying to undermine it with injunctions and appeals that aren't working, we let the mechanism roll out the way it's successfully been in other countries, we have a chance here. Thank you.
I hold the name Slato and Cassia House, which is the Grizzly Bear House, whose territory that you're on right now. I have a couple of concerns to address about what you said, your lack of knowledge of history. I also hold a master's degree in Indigenous governance from the University of Victoria. And I would just want to, I don't think that I'm going to change your minds about anything. That's not why I'm here. I'm here because I want other people to understand what is actually going on. People that do live in our community that may have some concerns that you've addressed and that you've brought up, and the way that you brought them up is very divisive, like everybody said. But this problem didn't start with DRIPA. This problem didn't start with Section 35 in the Constitution. The issue, you referred to it, the issue around Native people is actually what everybody has called the Indian problem. And that's what you're trying to address in the words that you just spoke. And that's a long-standing issue that our people have never ceded, surrendered, or treated any of our territories. 22,000 square kilometers of territory in Wet'suwet'en territory. Most of BC is untreated. The treaty system didn't work because we already have title over our territories. We already are sovereign nations. We don't need the Canadian government to tell us that that exists. Delgamuukus Dayway said that we have never ceded or surrendered or extinguished our title to 22,000 square kilometers of territory, as well as all of the hereditary lands in Gippsland territory.
Do that again.
So this problem of dividing and this conflict was caused by the Canadian government, by your government. It's perpetuated by your government, saying fear-mongering and saying that if we're allowed to make our laws, if we're allowed to enact our laws on our territory, that non-Native people are going to suffer. And that's a huge misunderstanding of what Anak-Nu-Ten is. That is our body of laws. That's how we govern. And I'm sorry to say, but the state of the world right now, is the Canadian government doing a good job? I would say no, probably not. UNDRIP is supposed to help address the conflict that was created by colonization, that created these two tiers of people, that used racism as a tool to dehumanize us, to rationalize the theft and the forceful illegal occupation of our territory. And so when you're talking about equal opportunity, my question is, equal opportunity for what? Because our vision of how we want to live in the north and our vision of how we implement Wet'suwet'en law on our territories doesn't look like what you're talking about. Equal opportunity for everybody is to live in a vibrant, beautiful place in the world where we can actually have peace, which our laws allow for after thousands and thousands of years of developing them on this land. That's what would happen. And it's only because of the Canadian interference and the Canadian state that keeps oppressing Indigenous people that has caused the conflict for people to come up and actually fight to have DRIPA. That's why conflict happened, in order for us to have DRIPA. And so my question is, equal opportunity for what? Because just like Madik said, it's your perspective about what equal opportunity looks like. That's your perspective from a colonizer viewpoint. And also, where did you get your history degree, because all of your facts are wrong. Alyssa.
You asked the question.
question. I do want to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to like speak, gets a chance to speak. You ask a question, so I do want to respond to that. And you asked the question of, you know, equal opportunity for who and in what perspective. What you're advocating for is that Canada no longer exists here in this territory because it's your sovereign nation. I'm sorry, I'm Canadian. I'm a proud Canadian. I'm British Columbian. I'm a proud British Columbian. And I'm not going to be advocating for the destruction of the Canada, the nation of Canada.
And also
that's my perspective.
You never said that.
Sovereign nation means that. Perhaps you should understand that side. I'm sorry if I've spent it. But sovereign nation means that you have complete control of yourself, which means Canada does not have authority. And British Columbia does not have authority. So that is what that means. And that's, if that's where it ultimately goes, if that's what society decides to do, well, then that's what will end up happening. But I'm certainly not going to be advocating for that.
Just a quick step in here from me. This is Brendan. This is the host of Syrup Moose Radio. I just wanted to first of all say I'm not somebody who finds like national or local pride to be particularly interesting. Like, I don't know that it's, you should necessarily be proud of a place that you just happen to be from. But I will say the woman's speech about Northern BC made me proud to live in the North. And, you know, she said, we've been living in the North forever. We've always had reconciliation here. We've always had truth here in the North. And with you coming today, because it's working in other areas of the province, it's not going to work in the North because we work together here. And I love that. And, you know, I don't always see that here, but I love that response. I also want to call out John Rastad for being deeply patronizing to the person, to the audience, with his comment about what the definition of sovereign nation is. And at no point did that speaker say that she was calling for the destruction of Canada and BC. And frankly, what the hell is Canada and BC that's so important anyway? As far as I'm concerned, it can all go. Burn it. In the legislative sense, obviously. It just, you really did see the active fear-mongering in like real time there. And I did think genuinely interesting that he did not answer the question about his education. And I did a very brief Google, and I also couldn't find his education. He, you know, grew up in a logging company family and worked as a school board trustee, but I don't know what his education is. And I think that's telling that he didn't want to say. And it is something, you know, all of these conservative voices like to give history lessons, but based on what? Right? All right, we're going to get back into it here. We are nearing the end of the first hour, so there may be an awkward cut coming up, but I'm going to play some more, and I might dip in later on as well. So here we go.
The federal government still treats Indigenous people as wards of the state. That's why there needs to be change. And, you know, and this isn't related to DRIPA, but there's a stat that I find extremely disturbing. Extremely disturbing. Over the last 5-6 years, the average life expectancy for First Nations has dropped by 6 years. That is, to me, is completely horrendous and unacceptable. Why? If we're doing such great things in this province and changing and DRIPA and all this kind of stuff, why suddenly has the average age dropped by 6 years for Indigenous people? That is something that needs to change. We can't carry on with the same path. Denise, Dakota,
Skaise, Saisozi, Kayla Mitchell, Lexilia Dista, Seneh Yeshni Giltehu, Seneh Crystal Granke, Sabet Rodney Mitchell, Tini Meskabu, Helen Mitchell, Tate Satana Delie Dittney Un, Kenny Mitchell, Tla Anito Ta Louise Granke, My grandma Louise used to own a restaurant here in this community called Louise's Kitchen. And when I was born, my mom had me at the age of 17. And she had me with my Wet'suwet'en father. His name's Rodney, and he's the most gentle and kind soul out there. And I lived this world between two of them. My mom's white, and many of you know her. And my grandmother has history from Romania and came over here with hers as well. And then I live here today as Deputy Chief of Wet'suwet'en First Nation, and I have been on council for the last 6 years. And I'm one of the youngest people on council. I've went to school. I've also had my time with drugs and alcohol, and I'm not ashamed of that. But I've also seen the healing work that our system does. And I've also witnessed the beauty of our system in the feast hall, where I've also been to the legislation of Canada, and in that space, I noticed there was a lot of anger and there was a lot of scrutiny from across the room. And I've never seen that in our governance hall, and it was appalling to me. And so when I'm talking to you today, I was taught by my elders, my grandma included, you have to think with your heart and your mind and work goddamn hard, and I do. I do work hard for my people, and I'm very passionate. I'm also from European descent, and I'm also passionate about that part of me. I also witness on my white side that my great aunt, she was raped over and over again by the Catholic priest when she went to go be a teacher at residential school. And when she had a problem and she needed to go to psychiatry, the psychiatrist raped her too. And so these type of issues are not singular to Indigenous people, but the issue of the Indian Act, as well as the repercussions of leaving us in the dark, has caused such issue and misinformation that is being spread, especially in the valley. My grandparents, Helen and Kenny, they had a cabin on their territory out near Houston, and in the 70s, Canfor had burnt it down, and Canfor had an agreement to pay them to help build it back because they had admitted fault. And before that, in the early 1900s, there is a case law called Gray versus Tyee, and it was a time when our medicine man was giving a ceremony around an afflicted individual. The RCMP came through the door and charged them, and they were charged with a year's wages for drumming and singing around an afflicted individual. That is against our rights. And at that time, we were not able to even hire litigation or have legal representation in the court of law when we were burnt off our territories and not able to even represent ourselves in a right way. So when you speak of equality, Mr. Rustad, I want to emphasize that there has never been equality, especially when we currently are not able to even own property on a reserve we've been allotted. How can we even be economically making it when we have no equity to even work with? So my question to you, well, I think there's a lot of things you can respond to, so I'll leave it there. Thank you.
So, first of all, thank you for standing up for the leadership of your community. You know, it's important, and thank you for that work you're doing. I couldn't agree more. There is not equality today, so I'm not talking about status quo. We've got to find a place where we get equal opportunity, and we're not there. We're nowhere close in terms of it. And so, you know, the issues you've raised is exactly that. How do we work through this so that there is that opportunity? Because you're right, you can't even own your own land on reserve. It's crazy. Why would we say that's what we should carry on with society? Of course that shouldn't happen. And First Nations should be able to have their laws and decisions and how those territories... And I also talk about, you know, I've talked about this many times publicly, so I'll repeat it here. I've also talked about the return of land strategically for creating those economic opportunities, for creating that potential. How do we address that so that it creates those potential?
And I'll just follow up. I know there's a lineup, so I'll leave it with this. But I share the same sentiment around shared decision-making and making sure we're well-informed before we jump too quickly into things, and that it's not just one body or one person that can make those decisions. We live together, we thrive in this community, and we can be better together. And I agree with the gentleman before me about how we talk to each other. It makes a difference. And when we believe in people, like young leaders like myself who are educated, who do the work, I have a lot of life in me. And I will knock on every door and sit with you to talk about what does it look like for the future. Because our laws have a place for love and connection. And in our feast hall, when we hire somebody, actually you pay them right front. All the finances are done in front of you, so you can't hide anything. And so that's a difference in the way that